Thank you, Todd, and thank you to all who read. In order to give tonight's speakers much time as he needs, I'm going to be brief. This man was special in my life. He gave me my first big book and did a lot of other great things to foster my recovery. And I'm going to give you John T.
Am I at about the right level with this thing back there? Is this better? You know, I was thinking while you folks were gathering and while we were doing our readings and especially the announcements that there's a great line in the big book that says, we are not a glum lot. We absolutely insist on enjoying ourselves. And you guys are definitely not a glum lot. And just about everybody I've encountered here tonight seems like they're really enjoying themselves, and you know, that's what AA is about. Thanks for sharing that with me. I need a lot of it. I appreciate it. And by the way, my name's John, and I'm an alcoholic. And my wife, Marcy, we're very close friends with Gary and his lovely wife, Diane. And I want to tell you, we really appreciate what you guys have done for Gary. And I want to thank Gary for asking me to be here tonight. And this first time I've ever had the pleasure or the privilege of speaking here at Ridgeview, so it's a privilege. You know, Gary has a place here. It's not just a building. It's not just an institution. But it's a safe place made up of people like you and me who have a common bond. This thing that brought us here, this alcoholism, addiction, is too much for us alone. We need each other. We need fellowship, and we need a program of spiritual recovery that works. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. My father was a Presbyterian minister and a professor of theology at a Presbyterian seminary. So I started off with some things to overcome right there. My mother was trained as a church organist, and they were wonderful, wonderful people, and both of them gave great, loving, caring service for many years in the world. Were greatly admired by all who knew them. I was a long time in AA before I began to realize what wonderful people they really were, and to accept and embrace the view that just about everybody else had of them. I became close to my father after I got in the program, and I became very close to my mother, who passed away in 2008 at the age of 103. So that kind of dates me a little bit. When I was in the fourth or fifth grade, my mother found out that I had been saying some naughty words at school. And so she made me, every day when I came home, she made me tell her if I'd said any naughty words. And I came home one day and she said, John, did you say any naughty words at school today? And I finally admitted that I had said one. Whereupon she washed out my mouth with soap. So at that time, I came to the conclusion that there was no benefit to telling the truth. So I stopped trying to do it. and this is, I've thought a lot about this, and it's literally true, that at age 8 or 9, I was living 2 lives. The person I really was, but I kept secret on the inside, and the person I wasn't, but I tried to demonstrate to you on the outside. I got busted by my mother all the time. I rarely got by with anything, and she would turn me over to my dad. And remember, this has been a long time ago, but she would turn me over to my dad, and he would administer the appropriate punishment, usually with a leather razor strap. I knew clearly what my parents' attitude towards drinking, smoking, carousing was. Over the years, I became an expert in all three of those areas. Any good Christian boy would use his willpower to resist such things. Thus, when I finally took my first drink at age 17, my senior year in high school, I felt shame, and I felt guilt, and I especially felt fear before I actually accepted a beer and took a pull off of a friend's beer. That night, I went home drunk and sick. My priorities in life changed that night. My attitude and outlook changed that night. My primary purpose changed that night. Drinking became the number one focus of my life, and everything else took second place. Family. My sweet little blonde girlfriend, Nancy, who later became my wife and the mother of my kids. Ambitions in life, friends, and most of the remaining moral principles that I still had left. I became alienated from and resentful of my family, and I could not wait to leave for college and get as far away from home as possible. So, with drinking and self-gratification as my primary purpose, it was amazing how fast I became an expert at both of those things. Within a year of the first drink, I was away at college in North Carolina at a little Presbyterian school named Davidson College, and I had achieved the ability to drink almost every night and yet still barely maintain good enough grades to stay in school. In my sophomore year, I dropped out of my fraternity house so I could keep the $25 a month that my parent sent me for food and buy beer at the local honky-tonk, which was known as the Anchor Grill. I ate Vienna sausage and saltine crackers in my dorm room for a month in order to pull this off. I got to know the Anchor's owner so well that he gave me a part-time job tending bar 2 nights a week, but I always went back to the dorm owing him more than he owed me. I was put on academic probation at the end of my sophomore year in 1960. So, I decided to drop out of college instead of going to summer school to get reinstated academically. And I got a job with the U.S. Forest Service out in the Idaho wilderness. Before leaving for Idaho, I stole a driver's license and a draft card from a friend of mine so I'd have ID to drink out west that summer. 18 years later, when I wrote that guy a Ninth Step amends letter, I got one of the most accepting and encouraging and forgiving letters I've ever received. I did have a few local drinking buddies that I met at the Anchor. And on the night before leaving for Idaho, one of them was coming to the Anchor to pick picked me up, and we were going to drive to Charlotte to go to have a going away drinking bash. He was so drunk coming to get me that he ran off the road and was killed. We heard the sirens of the police cars and the ambulance from the anchor. I'd already had plenty to drink, and I remember just sitting there the rest of the day and having very few feelings about what had just happened. 6 months later, I had returned to Richmond from Idaho, and I had a job driving a Coca-Cola truck. I met another drinking friend, and we decided one night that we were going to get together and go out for a wild evening. He never showed up where we were to meet. He was killed in an automobile wreck on the way to meet me. The irony and the tragedy and the warning of these two experiences escaped my conscious comprehension until I'd been in AA for several years. I didn't go to either funeral, and I frankly don't remember having too many feelings about either one of those guys for many years later. I was emotionally and spiritually dead, and I was 20 years old. Driving a Coke truck was hard work with low pay, and I decided that it was incompatible with my need for much more money, much less work, much more time to drink, and especially the image that I wanted you to have of me. So I went back and finished college, and I convinced my sweet little blonde girlfriend, Nancy, to marry me. And back in those days, you didn't have much choice where you went after that, so I went straight into the U.S. Army, spent 3 years in the Army as an officer and an Army aviator. We had two lovely children during that time. I still had 10 more years of active drinking to do when I got out of the Army. When I brought my family to Atlanta in 1966 to start my business career at one of the local banks, I was already living on borrowed time and escaping the just consequences of all my addictive and dangerous choices in life. Nancy and I bought a little brick bungalow in Clarkston with a VA loan and settled into our new life. This next thing won't surprise you. It didn't take me long to find a new drinking buddy at the bank named Fred. Soon Fred and I were out every night after work, drinking and carousing and coming home drunk all hours of the night, scaring our wives to death. We didn't care about them or our kids. We just wanted to party, have a good time. Fred was a little guy, sort of a cross between Danny DeVito and Joe Pesci. Brazen, pugnacious, and he liked to go down to the black folks' honky-tonks on Auburn Avenue. This was in the mid-1960s during the Civil Rights Revolution. It scared me to death, but those black folks down there just loved him. One morning, Fred and I woke up in a motel room with no recollection of what had happened or where we'd been the night before. That's the way life was for these two church-going family men with professional jobs at the local bank. On another night, I had tickets to take my family to the Omni downtown. We were going to see a performance by Olga Korbut, the famous Russian gymnast. But Fred and I stayed out drinking so long that by the time I got home, it was almost too late to make it to the performance. Nancy did not want to put the kids in the car with me. She begged me to let her drive. I was having none of it, and I herded her and the kids into the car and sped off. They were terrorized by my driving. We arrived at our seats just as the performance was starting, but I decided that I needed a beer, so I made my oldest son, Jay, go with me to the concession stand to get a beer. And on the way back to our seats, I stumbled on the steps and spilled the beer all over the person who was sitting just behind us, with my son, Jay, standing there watching. Nancy and I eventually divorced. We were on good terms. We're still on good terms. She's a wonderful lady. And many, many years after that event, she told me one time something that Jay said. Jay went to her and he said, when he was 7 or 8 years old, "Mom, how come Dad doesn't play with me the way the other dads play with their kids?" And I can remember evenings at night sitting on the sofa. My beautiful daughter Beth would be sitting next to me. I'd be sending Jay off to the refrigerator every 15 or 20 minutes to get me another beer. And I would have this overwhelming desire just to reach out, put my arms around my daughter Beth and tell her I loved her. But I was frozen in place and I could not do it. Nancy would say, "John, please stop drinking." And I would say, "I could stop drinking anytime I want to. I just don't want to." I will tell you that the day came when I wanted to and I could not do it. Meanwhile, my business career prospered. I was good at bluffing my way through the necessary things in life. I was recruited by a New York investment firm to set up a local Atlanta office. So we bought a bigger house, had a third baby, and I became an officer of the church. I traveled a lot. And all my work associates were in New York. I became a loner and loved being on the road so I could drink and carouse away from anyone who knew me. Later on, another investment company recruited me to an even better job, but that required me to dress up and go downtown to an office every day. And by that time, my patterns of isolation and drinking were well established, and it didn't go very well at that company because the people there began to realize that this guy, John, had some strange behaviors that were going on, and my job performance got progressively worse. I was a constant drunk driver. Never occurred to me that I could not function behind the wheel. I had years of close calls, but no accidents or arrests until my consequences finally began to catch up with me. I reached the point where I was a blackout, solitary drinker, anonymous, seeking lower places and lower people. One night by myself, I was drinking at a bar near 10th Street and Peachtree, and I went into a blackout, and I came 2 hours later at a bar down south of the airport, seated at a table with six other people sitting there that I did not know. They invited me to come to a house party with them, but on the way, I went into another blackout. I woke up the next morning on the floor wrapped in a blanket, and those people were not being as nice to me as they had been the night before. So I hit the road out of there as fast as I could, but on the way out of the driveway, my rear bumper caught on a chain link fence, and I dragged it halfway up the street before it finally fell off. But by some miracle, I made it to work that day. But I was terrified the whole day, expecting the cops to come bursting in at any moment, take me off in handcuffs. In January of 1976, I received a call from my old friend Fred. Fred had moved to Savannah years before, and I hadn't seen him for years. He was coming to Atlanta on business and wanted to come by and see me. I was thrilled, and I had plenty of booze and beer ready for when he got there. I offered him a drink when he got there, but he politely declined. I got one for myself, and we sat down, and Fred told me the story of his drinking nightmare in Savannah. He lost his business. He almost lost his family. He went bankrupt and off to jail numerous times. But Fred looked different. Happy, healthy, peaceful. He reached in his pocket and he pulled out a green poker chip and showed it to me. And he said that some people at Alcoholics Anonymous had given it to him on his 9-month sobriety date, and that they had helped him stop drinking, and he just wanted to share his good news with me. He never said anything to me about my drinking. Then he got up, smiled, gave me a hug, and left. Years later, I found out that Fred didn't have a business appointment in Atlanta that day. He drove all the way to Atlanta just to see me. Fred's carrying the message of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous to me saved my life. At first, though, I did everything I could do to prove that I was not like Fred and I did not need any help to stop drinking. I got a great idea. I would just control my drinking. So I did everything I could think of to do that. Many years later, I found out this list is in the big book, but I didn't know it at the time. Drank only beer. Here's one I bet a lot of you haven't done. Drink only liqueur. Drink only at night. Drink only on weekends. Drink only during the week. And on and on. I only got worse. About a month after Fred came to see me, I was out again cruising and drinking around the seedy parts of Atlanta in my nice company car. And I went into a blackout and got lost. When I came to, I was curb bound on a side street that I had never seen before, and I was gunning my accelerator and shifting from forward to reverse, trying to rock myself off this curb. I noticed there was a police car parked behind me. And he'd given me quite a wide berth, too. The cop got out, came, put me in handcuffs, and put me in the rear seat of his car. And we were about 100 feet behind my car. While we were waiting for the paddy wagon to come and get me, my car burst into flames and then exploded. All my rocking had superheated the metal undercarriage. If that cop had not been there, I would have been killed in that explosion. I got to spend that night in the Grady lockup in the old Atlanta City Jail drunk tank. My boss then was the CEO of the company. He should have fired me many times over, but confrontation was not his thing. And he just put up with my poor job performance and various bizarre behaviors and late arrivals and early departures. And I conjured up a cock and bull story for him about how my company car burned up. And he accepted it and said, go ahead and buy another one. So, the dealer tag was still on my brand new 1976 yellow Buick LeSabre with a tan vinyl top on the evening of April the 27th, 1976. I'd been having a late evening of work with the company auditors, you guessed it, followed by some drinking at one of the local bars. I went into another blackout and ran a stop sign at 17th and Spring Street straight into the path of an oncoming taxi cab. The cab T-boned me on the driver's side, knocked the car all the way across the intersection. One of the company auditors was with me in the shotgun seat, and there were five people in the taxi cab. We all seven walked away unhurt. Both doors on my car were smashed shut, and we had to wait to be pried out. While I was trapped in my seat, and with all the commotion going on outside, I had the first moment of clarity I ever had about my life and my drinking. I said in my mind, God, please help me. I can't do this anymore. I'm going to go to that AA place that my friend Fred told me about and ask them to help me stop drinking. That was 4 months after Fred had come to see me. I was almost 36 years old, and I had been drinking for 18 and a half years. By God's grace and the help that I've received from hundreds of wonderful people like you in AA, I have not had another drink since that night. Thank God and thank AA that all three of my wonderful kids, my wonderful former wife Nancy, all four of my wonderful grandchildren, love me today, respect me, and they want me in their lives. What a gift. My youngest son, Phil, was 5 years old when I got sober. None of my grandkids has ever seen me drunk. I was fortunate to still have my job when I got to AA. The job required a fair amount of travel, but I had managed to stay off the road for about the first 90 days of my sobriety. Traveling and being alone in another city was a major drinking trigger for me. But the day came when I had to go to Houston on a business trip, and I was very nervous about how it would be with me on that trip. So my AA sponsor, Hubert, and I sat down and we researched meetings in Houston and found one near the motel where I was going to be staying. When I got there, I checked into the motel and I left in plenty of time to get to the meeting. Actually, I was over 30 minutes early to the meeting. Parking lot was empty, so I sat in the car, breathed deeply, said the Serenity Prayer. No cell phones in those days to call your sponsor or call your AA buddies. I went into the church and I couldn't find anybody. Returned to the car and I began to be very anxious about what am I supposed to do next? Nobody's here. I began to think about the people at my home group. And I would have given almost anything if just one of them had been there to talk with me that night. About that time, a car pulled up, then another, then another, and folks began to go inside. I went in to see where they were, found the room they were in, and it was AA. They welcomed me happily and took care of me for the rest of the night. In my haste to get to that meeting, I had failed to realize that I was now in the Central Time Zone. I was over an hour and a half early for that meeting. This was one of the most valuable early experiences I had in my AA journey. I became vividly aware of the tremendous gift of AA to the suffering alcoholic. The gift of another understanding alcoholic to help each other stay sober. I realized that this was exactly what happened to Bill Wilson in the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio in 1935. After about a year and a half in the program, my life and my circumstances had gotten much better, and the consequences and wreckage of my drinking escapades had been resolved. And I told Hubert that I really loved AA, but I was busy in my work and with my family, and I wouldn't be having as much time to go to AA meetings anymore as I had previously had. Hubert thought for a minute, and then he said, "John, our AA literature does not say that AA and our program are our only purpose. It says they are our primary purpose." I had to learn that lesson over again many, many years later. I went through a period of time about 16 years ago, roughly, when I went almost 2 years without going to an AA meeting. I developed a serious and dangerous dry drunk. The consequences were that when I came to the point where I had slipped away from AA meetings and AA friends and fellowship, I did not have the spiritual resources necessary to keep from slipping back into almost all of my character defects. I am grateful that I returned to AA without drinking, but I cannot say that AA principles were anywhere evident in my life at that time. I did not drink, but I sure did stink. After that long dry drunk, I returned with passion and commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, to the fellowship, and to the 12-step recovery program. Now, in my first year of AA, I had honestly worked through the 12 steps with my sponsor, Hubert, and I was fully and thoroughly grounded in the surrender of step one, and I had benefited enormously from the inventory steps four and five, and I had benefited enormously from the amends steps eight and nine. However, I can see that as I got closer and closer to that lapse away from meetings, that I had been paying less and less attention to practicing the principles, and I had been falling into the category of a sobriety based primarily on relationships and fellowship. I was practicing personalities over principles. Rather than principles over personalities, as is suggested in our 12th tradition about anonymity. I had, in fact, forgotten the line in the Big Book which says, "We are given a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition." I did have a God of my understanding, but I had turned that God into a Bush League pinch hitter, as described in our wonderful AA book, 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. I failed to place the God of my understanding first in my life. About a year after I had come passionately back to AA, I was asked to lead a meeting on step 6. That step says, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And as is my nature, I studied and prepared to get ready to lead this meeting. And I began to share my comments and thoughts during the discussion period ahead of the meeting. And while I was sharing about all the work I had done to get over my character defects, it finally came to me that step 6 and step 7 are not about my character defects. They are about reconnecting with the spiritual attitude of step 1, 2, and 3. And I think for me this attitude is well expressed in our literature. And by the way, I love our literature. But as you will all recall, is read pretty much at every meeting at the end of How It Works, we have what we call three pertinent ideas. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could relieve our alcoholism. That God could and would if he were sought. We AAs like short things, and so we've got a good way to shorten that up even a little more with our saying, let go and let God. When I was drinking, my primary purpose was to drink and to fulfill my own selfish and self-centered desires for myself. And by practicing that behavior, what materialized for me and my family was chaos, heartbreak, anger, alienation, misery. As an active member of AA, whose primary purpose is to stay sober and help others to stay sober, what materializes for me is peace, serenity, contentment, happiness, loving relationships. The past 14 years of active AA involvement have truly been the best years of my life. I have a loving God that I have learned to put first in all things. I have sobriety, I have the steps, I have a wonderful wife, Marcy, who supports me in my AA and encourages me in it. I have a loving family. I have wonderful friends in AA, including friends with whom I share very deeply and personally on a deep level. As my sponsor Hubert said all those many years ago, I know my primary purpose. May the God of your understanding bless each of you as you continue in your journey in sobriety. And let me say again, I'm honored to have been asked to speak here at Ridgeview tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you for that message. And at this point, I'd like Jennifer is going to assist us with our chips tonight.